Part 1. The End of Easy Oil. 1. One right answer. Sidney J. Riso was typical of the men who rose into Exxon's senior leadership ranks. An engineer by academic training, an Exxon employee for life, married for 37 years to his wife Patricia, and quietly appreciative of his privileges as his wealth grew. He maintained a membership at the Spring Brook Country Club near his office in New Jersey and owned a vacation condominium by the shore in Florida. He was not a man given to radical decisions or departures. It did not augur well, then, when a neighbor discovered his car idling with the driver's side door open at the end of his 250-foot driveway on a wooded cul-de-sac in Morris Township at 8 a.m. on the morning of April 29, 1992. Riso had passed through the front door of his large brick and clapboard home as usual at 7:30 a.m. that Thursday morning to make the 15-minute drive to his office in Florham Park. There he served as the president of a large international Exxon division responsible for oil and gas exploration and production outside of North America. Police quickly circulated flyers seeking information about a missing white man, 5 feet 10 inches tall, 180 pounds, with blue eyes and gray hair showing a reddish tint. Lawrence J. Rawl, Exxon's soon-to-retire chief executive, and his successor, Lee Raymond, were together at an Exxon board of directors meeting in Dallas. The annual shareholder meeting would soon begin. Each year, the board held a meeting beforehand. Resolutions and board member election voting passed in a ritualized, scripted session. A senior executive in Exxon's security department entered and leaned over Lee Raymond's shoulder as he read out to the room from prepared materials. "I've got to talk to you," he said. "Right now." Raymond excused himself and returned a few minutes later to report, "Sid's been kidnapped." The board sat in silence. Kidnappings were a periodic threat. Attempts against executives came and went in waves. In 1974, Exxon had paid $14 million to free one of its executives, Victor Samuelson, from the Marxist People's Revolutionary Army in Argentina. The feeling in the room was, not another one. Rawl was stunned. Riso had worked directly for him for years. A telephone caller had already issued a ransom demand to the corporation, security reported. Rawl called in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Its director, William Sessions, began to call Raymond each morning to deliver updates. Running their investigation out of Newark, FBI agents required several days to conclude that the initial caller seemed to be authentic. A ransom note demanded that Exxon gather $18.5 million in old $100 bills, load them into laundry bags, and prepare for a drop. The demand came from the Fernando Pereira Brigade, Warriors of the Rainbow. The name referred to the freelance photographer who drowned in the Pacific Ocean in 1985 when French intelligence agents sank the Rainbow Warrior, a vessel belonging to Greenpeace, the environmental crusaders, as it led a seaborne protest against nuclear weapons testing in French Polynesia. Since the Exxon Valdez spill, Greenpeace had made Exxon a prominent target of its anti-oil campaigning, but the group propounded nonviolence and civil disobedience, not kidnapping. "This tragic allegation does a real disservice to legitimate environmental organizations working to protect our global environment," its executive director Steve Desposito told a reporter while denying any involvement. The kidnappers communicated sporadically after their initial ransom demand. The FBI's agents spread out across New Jersey to conduct a massive investigation. Patricia Riso twice appeared on television to issue appeals on behalf of her family.
"Wherever he is, I wonder if he's cold," she said of her husband, "because his overcoat was in the car."
As the weeks passed, the kidnappers threatened a wider war against Exxon.
"If you choose not to pay, Riso will die in 24 hours, a letter delivered in early June declared. "If you interfere in any way with the money delivery prior to Riso's release, we will strike at our selected targets. These people will not be seized, that is, kidnapped, but will be treated as soldiers in war."
Rawl and Raymond visited the FBI's task force in Newark and were deeply impressed by the scale of the effort. In this age before cell phones, the Bureau's investigators hypothesized that the kidnapper would use a public payphone to communicate. They also figured he was probably still in the area. The task force rounded up enough agents to stake out every payphone within a 20-mile radius of the kidnapping site. On the night of June 18th, one of these FBI surveillance teams watched a blonde man wearing gloves make a telephone call at a payphone at a New Jersey shopping mall. The agents followed the caller's Oldsmobile and arrested the man shortly after midnight. In the car, they found laundry bags and a briefcase containing a 1985 directory of the home addresses of Exxon executives. Sessions called Raymond. "I think we got him." Arthur Seal grew up as the son of a policeman in Hillside, New Jersey, a middle-class town of about 20,000. At 21, he married a wealthy town girl, Jackie Sarko, whose parents owned properties, a liquor store, and a delicatessen. Arthur followed his father onto the Hillside Police Force, but was suspended twice and fined 3 times in 6 years for defying orders and drawing his gun inappropriately. He later resigned with a $10,000 annual injury pension and took a job in Exxon's security department in the New York area. He worked initially as a chauffeur. Whether Exxon knew of his trouble in Hillside before it hired him is not clear, but Seal performed well enough to move up to a corporate security position in Florham Park, where he earned as much as $60,000 in salary. He became angry, however, when former FBI agents were promoted ahead of him, and in 1987, Exxon dismissed him. He nurtured a grudge against the oil company and the FBI.